This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're closing out our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. We've had a wonderful time these past 4 weeks looking closely at the shortlists of nominees from the various categories. Indiana Humanities announced the winners yesterday, and this hour we'll hear from some of those winners. We'll start with the drama category. Playwright James Still wrote The Jack Plays. James Still, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Matt. I'm glad to be here.
So tell me about The Jack Plays.
The Jack Plays are three plays. It's a trilogy about a contemporary American family, spans about, about 5 years in this family's life. And each play is set in a different place in the world. The first play is set in Vermont at Thanksgiving, and the second play takes place in Venice, Italy, and the third play takes place in Aden, Yemen. So it really is sort of a global experience as you follow this family through some particularly challenging and love-filled time with them.
So yours is one of the few interviews that I'm actually getting to do after we found out that you've won the Indiana Authors Award.
Yeah.
I don't know, how did that feel when you found that out?
Oh, Matt, you know, I am not an artist in pursuit of awards, so I don't think about awards as, you know, obviously when I'm writing, I'm not ever thinking, oh, wow, this is going to win some big award. Having said that, I also must say getting that news was incredibly exciting for me. It was very meaningful. This is a time when all the theaters in the country are dark. And so without theaters doing our work, having my work recognized this way by the Indiana Authors Awards, it's very moving. I'm so grateful to everyone involved. And I also want to give a big shout out to a couple of organizations who really had a hand in these three plays. And that is the Indiana Repertory Theater, where I am the playwright in residence. And the IRT is the only theater in the country to have done all three plays at different times. So our audiences have gotten to follow this family through these three plays. And the other organization is the New Harmony Project, based down in New Harmony, Indiana, at the Writers' Conference there, where I worked on all three of these plays at different times while I was in residence. And so both of these organizations and so many audience members in Indiana have left beautiful Indiana fingerprints all over these plays, and I'm extremely proud of that.
James, I'm a huge fan of live theater. I miss it so badly.
Yeah.
And I've not thought about picking up a playbook and reading it during the pandemic and maybe getting my fix that way. Have you heard of anyone doing that?
Well, you know, the thing, Matt, is that, to be honest with you, plays are hard to read because they're written to be performed.
Yeah.
Every play I write, my hope, of course, is that it's going to end up on a stage somewhere and that I'm going to be sitting in a dark room with often a bunch of strangers watching this thing that I wrote. Given that that's not possible right now, that's another reason why this award is so meaningful, because at a time when I can't share my work as performance, the idea that I might be able to share it with readers, it is sort of a new idea in many ways. You know, you can go to your public library and they will have plays on the shelf. I certainly read plays as a young person. That's how I even learned what a play looked like on a page, you know, like how do you even put it on a page? But it's a different experience. It's a very private experience when you read a play, as opposed to the communal experience that it is when you're sitting in an audience watching a play, because you're having that communal experience with everyone in that audience, with the actors who are sharing the story with you. So it is a different experience, but one that, again, I have to say, I'm extremely grateful for during this time.
James Still wrote The Jack Plays, and it won in the drama category of the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. James Still, congratulations and thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Matt. Great to be with you.
And now for the winner in the fiction category. Chris White wrote the novel The Life List of Adrian Mandrick. Chris White, welcome to All In.
Thank you so much. Just delighted to be here.
So this is your first novel?
This is my first novel. Yeah, I had started out as a playwright and a screenwriter, and also actually was in the music business for quite a while. But I've been working on this quite a few years, and yeah, it's my debut novel.
So what's it about? Can you give me a quick off-the-cuff synopsis?
So it's about an anesthesiologist who's married, has two children, lives in Boulder, Colorado. And he's one of the top birders in the North American birding region, which means he has actually the third longest life list of species seen over the course of his life of anyone in this region. And he gets a call early on in the book from his estranged mom. He immediately hangs up, and it brings up a lot of issues for him that sort of compel him even more into his obsession with finding the bird and being the top of the list of birders. At a certain point, a certain bird seems to have been spotted that he then spends much of the book going after, rather than dealing with any of these issues that are being brought up for him. He also has a bit of a problem with painkillers and things like that he kind of goes back into. There is humor in the book, though, I want to say. I know it sounds all very intense, but it's I hope it's humorous as well.
As I understand it, this book did what a lot of novels do. It started as one thing and it turned into something else. How did it change as you were writing it?
I think the very first piece of it came when I was, you know, in that classic situation of I'm on a plane next to a stranger, and somehow or other, the stranger ended up telling me the story of a birder. I wasn't even really thinking about birders in my life at that time, but he told me the story of a top level birder who had gotten word of a certain important species that was in a couple states over, and he got in his car with his wife, and the two of them were quickly driving toward this bird, and they stopped to get gas, and he got back in the car and forgot his wife at the gas station.
Oh my goodness.
Going for a couple of hours before he remembered. And so I don't know, that story, I was going through really rough times with my own marriage at the time, and there was something about that story that made me feel like very compelled by that character and by that scenario, I guess. And it really is what sent me down this path.
So the main perspective went from one character to another as you were writing it. And of course the story came about in the way you just described, but how much did you fight that? I mean, I feel like I would have gotten mad at the book as I was writing it. Like, no, I want to tell this story.
Well, yeah, it started off actually in had multiple perspectives, but the main perspective was the perspective of Adrian's wife for a number of drafts. And it just kind of kept pecking at me like a woodpecker, that Adrian's story was the one that was drawing my focus more and more. And ultimately he became, you might say, a sort of antagonist in the original several drafts, and then over time became the protagonist. Mm.
What finally made you decide to give in and tell it the way you ultimately did?
Well, there are a couple phases of it. At one point in the progress of writing the book, I just sort of had gotten to the point where I was spending all this time on his perspective and he was starting to take over, but there were still these other perspectives, or a number of them. I think there were like five or six perspectives, different characters whose points of view we learn the story through. And so I had started realizing that it was more his story sort of on my own. And then there came a point where a visiting writer to the DePauw Kelly Writer series, Robert Boswell, very, very famous veteran novelist. I met him and he offered to read the book. A couple of days later, got back to me and just said in this beautiful set of notes that he sent me that, you know, were a godsend, said, yeah, you're right, it's his story, but everybody else needs to go and it needs to be completely his story.
Oh, really? So you jettisoned all the other perspectives?
Yep. Wow. And that was a very big revision process. And I was, you know, and even he said, some of the most beautiful stuff is going to be cut. Mm. And you need to figure out how you're going to put that into his perspective somehow, or get rid of it, or whatever you need to do. And so I did it, and I felt that he was right. And then eventually it became the book it is now.
Are you comfortable telling us what's next in your career?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I started working on another book not long after that, the Life List of Adrian Mandrick, was published, and actually have completed what I think is a pretty good draft, and got that to my agent actually just before COVID hit. So it's a little like, for many of us, the timing of a pandemic has not been convenient, to put it mildly, and devastating in many, many ways. So I'm just sort of like, yeah, I can wait. We'll see what happens. And, you know, much of the industry, especially fiction, from what my agent tells me, has been kind of to a crawl or to a halt for the time being. But I'm excited. I'm excited to work on it more with an editor once if that happens. I sort of went the complete other direction with the book, you know, after spending so many years with this man, this protagonist in my book. This is all female perspective in this new book. And there are a number of, I'm back to the several points of view.
Well, it sounds like you got to do what you originally wanted to do in telling it from multiple perspectives. And you got to write a book more from a perspective that maybe you were more used to. Do you feel like that's the case with this next one?
You know, the truth is, I think I've always had the most challenges dealing with characters like myself. I started out also doing some acting earlier in my life, and I always found that to be the case. If the character was more different from me, the easier it was for me to play.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's a big challenge to write all these female perspectives in a different kind of way than was writing his. I mean, but they're all quite different from each other. So yeah, I really liked doing it, and we'll see where it goes from here, I guess.
Chris White, thanks and best of luck.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Chris White is the author of The Life List of Adrian Mandrick, and it won this year's Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award for Fiction. Up next, the winners in the Young Adult, Poetry, and Children's categories. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in less than 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're closing out our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards by celebrating the winners in each category. We'll start this segment with Sondra Mitchell, who wrote the young adult novel All the Things We Do in the Dark. Sondra Mitchell, welcome to All In.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So tell me about All the Things We Do in the Dark.
All the Things We Do in the Dark is a book for teens, but of course anybody of any age can read it if they like to. It's about a young woman who experienced sexual assault early in her life and has to learn how to essentially survive for the rest of her life through that, because there are always things that your body remembers and that your skin remembers. And so that's kind of tough to navigate all of your firsts when you have that in your history. But it's about a young woman who finds another young woman murdered in the woods, and because of her experience with law enforcement from her assault, she decides that rather than give that girl's body up, that she's going to solve the murder herself.
Okay. I have so many questions, but I guess I have to read the book. So I don't know, what kind of message were you trying to send with this book?
You know, All the Things We Do in the Dark was a very difficult book for me to write because, you know, I myself am a survivor of sexual assault. And so there are a lot of dark places that survivors go to and that they have to get through. And a lot of times the resources are not there, or, you know, your family environment is not supportive, or you just don't have a safety net and you have to figure out how to get by on your own. And this is a book that I wrote because it's a book that I needed when I was 16. You know, I needed a book that said, it's not just you when you have nightmares night after night. It's not just you when you can't hold hands in a certain way because it makes you feel sick all over again. And so one of the things I wanted to do with this book was to reach out to survivors, because we do go on. People like to minimize sexual assault to, you know, it was 5 minutes that happened all those years ago, but it truly is something that we hold for our whole lives that affects us each step of the way. So really part of the message, really the main message is for, you know, sexual assault survivors, you are not alone. You're not doing this by yourself. Just knowing that you're not alone as you move through these things is so huge.
There's some heavy subject matter, obviously, in this book, but it's also really entertaining in a lot of places. In what ways did you bring relief to the page?
You know, every book that I write, there's humor in it because, quite frankly, that's the way life is. I mean, you know, you can be having a terrible day and still find something amusing. You can be going through a hard time and still be interested in, say, going to a concert with your favorite band. So I feel like that this is a book that does have lots of dark heaviness in it, but I think that there's also humor in it, and I think there's life in it. And there's a really, I think, compelling murder mystery to it. Because once Ava, the main character, discovers the body in the woods and decides that she's going to solve the murder, well, she starts seeing who she thinks is the ghost of this girl everywhere around her. So, you know, if you like spooky mystery, if you like, you know, detective stories, like young detective stories, that's what this book is also.
What would you like to tell any potential reader? And again, this is the winner in the young adult category. But again, anyone of any age could appreciate this book. But what would you like to tell maybe a younger reader who is experimenting with creativity, but maybe having a few doubts about whether or not they could, I don't know, put their thoughts to the page themselves?
You know what? You are allowed. I want to emphasize that so much because I grew up in Indiana before the internet. And so, you know, even then, especially then, there was this idea that if you wanted to make films or if you wanted to make art or if you wanted to write stories or books, that you had to go to New York or you had to go to Los Angeles. It's just not the case. Plus, you know, I grew up super poor. I could not afford to go to college. So I have had the kind of life where it's like, oh, well, you know, I've worked at the gas station and at video stores and things like that. I don't have a special degree. I didn't know somebody in publishing before I started doing this. I learned how to do everything that I could through the library, and I did it from Indiana. And so I really, really want to emphasize that I only have a high school diploma and they let me write novels for a living. So I just want, especially young people, especially young creative people who may feel like, you know, oh, I can't go to that expensive school on the East Coast or whatever. You can still write books. You can still make movies. You can still make art right here in Indiana.
Just like Sandra Mitchell, she's the author of All the Things We Do in the Dark, and it won the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award in the Young Adult category this year. Sandra, congratulations on the award, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And now something for the little kids, but the adults can appreciate this too. The true story of the school that changed the capital city. Philip Hose, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Matt.
So Hoosiers out there that are big basketball fans are likely familiar with the story of the Crispus Attucks Tigers and their 1955 state championship win. But for those who are unfamiliar, what's the story there?
Well, the story is that in 1927, Crispus Attucks High School was built with taxpayer money to quarantine Black students and teachers to keep them apart from the white population. One of the first things the school tried to do was gain membership to the Indiana High School Athletic Association so they could play in the state tournament. And they were rejected and rejected and rejected. They tried year after year after year, and they could not get in until really World War II. And they finally began to build a program made up of boys that had come up from the South on buses with their parents as part of the first great migration of blacks north. They didn't know how to play basketball. They had been, you know, used to doing farm work, but they got a great coach in Ray Crow and began to learn the game. And really the community got together behind them. They went all the way to the Final Four in 1951. Then the Robertson family moved to Indianapolis from Tennessee. That's Oscar Robertson, one of the great players that ever lived.
Sure.
And it all came together in 1955. They won the state championship, beating out 700 and some other schools, and gained the respect that they had so sought as African Americans to by winning the state tournament.
Why was it important to you to tell this story?
Well, I grew up in Indiana, and it was always weird to me that there was a school that all blacks had to go to. I went to Speedway High School, and it was just 6 miles down 16th Street from Crispus Attucks High School. And yet those 6 miles, they might have been universes, you know, and I wondered a lot about it. Later, after I had moved away from Indiana, I got a magazine assignment from Sports Illustrated to do some interviewing about why Indiana was such a crazy basketball state, why it seemed to mean so much there. And in the course of all that, I met Oscar Robertson, who was a hero of mine, and got to talk with him for a while. And at one point he said, people in Indianapolis were crazy. It was crazy when the Klan built our school. And I said, what do you mean the Klan built your school? And he said, yeah, that's true. The Ku Klux Klan put up the money to build the school. And I said, well, tell me all you know about it. He didn't know much. And he said, you're the writer, you do the research. And so so I did. I did the research, and I found that not only in the 1920s was one of every three white males in Indiana a member of the Ku Klux Klan, but it affected so many families, including my own. I found out that my grandfather was a Klansman, that my Aunt Anne's first memory was going to a cross burning, that my Aunt Ellen, my dear Aunt Ellen, who saved pennies in a jar for me, had a property, and in the deed to the property, it said that it could never be sold to a black, a Catholic, or a Jew. I mean, this was everywhere. It infected everything in Indiana there for a while. And so I just wanted to write about it.
Has this book been used in educational settings?
In Indiana, it has, not so much elsewhere.
And in what ways? Do you know where? Or have you been able to talk to any of the classrooms using it?
Yeah, I've done some touring with the book, in mainly in Eastern and Midwestern states and cities. It's not a very well-known story. It is in Indiana, but it's not elsewhere. And people's eyes widen, you know, they can't believe that this had happened. Most people don't know, even despite the movie Hoosiers, how big a deal basketball was and still is really in Indiana. 13 of the 14 biggest high school gyms in the United States are still in Indiana. Communities emptied their checkbooks and pocketbooks to build big gyms that were bigger than the gym down the road so they could host the sectional tournament. It was just nuts, you know, in Indiana.
What do you hope readers take away from this?
I hope that they take away that Jim Crow was not just a Southern bird, that it was also a Hoosier bird. And I hope that they can admire the resilience and toughness of the Crispus Attucks community. Basically, they spent 25 years trying to win one basketball game, the state championship, and they did it. They cracked the door for the ability to even play in the tournament because they were rebuffed for so long. But I want them to know that Indiana was a tough place to be African-American, that kids made an enormous difference, that Indiana was a state where racial progress was made, albeit by an unusual way, through basketball.
Philip Hose is the author of Addicts, Oscar Robertson, and the Basketball Team That Awakened a City. Phil, great to talk with you today.
Great to talk with you, Matt. Thanks a lot.
Phil's book won him this year's Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award in the Children's Book category. Today we're celebrating this year's winners, which were announced yesterday. And now, from prose to poetry. Eugene Gloria has written four books of poetry, including Sightseer in This Killing City, which took this year's prize. Eugene Gloria, it's great to have you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Eugene, you brought a poem to read for us today. What is it?
This poem is called My Lanky Landlocked So-and-So for my collection, Sightseer in This Killing City. My lanky landlocked so-and-so. In my recent past, I was in Indiana. Our present business is loving in Indiana. I'm going abroad, I told my professor. What's her name? He asked. My uptake then was slow. I was that. But I am now not an Indiana. If I come back, I won't ever owe a nickel to Indiana. Each month, my bank will tally a tidy sum for my depositories. Someone's gonna get this dollar, man said to the porter. Come back to Indiana, not too late. It's only the plentiful, all-grabbing sky. And when 24 blackbirds began to bake into a pie, in Indiana. Wasn't that a Dixie chopper who cried, never, 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 before the fool in iambic pentameter? And princes, astride their mowers, bareback to sun their hides, and bake before the king. So many birds will black out the sun in Indiana. I am that, and my threats of return.
So Sightseer in This Killing City is your fourth collection of poetry. What did you explore with this one?
Well, I was really interested in examining the idea of movement and also sort of playing with the idea of persona. And so there was a character in the book. Her name is Nasarima, which is American spelled backwards. And she bops all over the world. She's sort of a traveler. And in a way, she's kind of a stand-in for me as a poet, but also as a kind of an American, Filipino-American, with a sort of fluid gender identity. And so I was exploring that. But I think really what they always turn out for me is that it's always this constant conversation I have with other poets and, you know, allowing music to sort of enter into the language of poetry. And so I have quotes from Coltrane and, you know, Thelonious Monk. They sort of appear in the poems as well as a kind of background into the language of the poems. And so that's also at play. But really, it's just always a book about language, really. I mean, that's the simplest way I can describe what the experience of the book is to me.
Your life and your career is taking you a lot of places. So there's a lot in here that one, I guess, could point elsewhere for the tone or the identity. But what's in here on Indiana? Were you thinking specifically about Indiana when you wrote any of these poems?
At one time I was. I was interested in continuing a kind of narrative about place, but also about displacement. And so having lived in Indiana all these many years, I've been living here for 20 years now. And so it wasn't really my idea to say, okay, this is going to be an Indiana book. But of course, there are experiences that emerge from living here. And so when I was thinking of a new book, I thought about this sign that, you know, that was a marquee in a strip mall in Plainfield, Indiana. And I remember, I mean, I would see this every time I come home from coming from the airport. I'm driving through Plainfield and I see the sign and it read karate, guns, and tanning. And somehow that sort of resonated with me, that spoke to me about what I think the American experience is, in particular the Midwest, but also that the idea of, you know, this is a place where you can get everything for the whole entire family. You know, you karate for the kids and, you know,
tanning for mom and you know, guns for dad, you know. So it was like, yeah, that's America. And so that was an idea that I wanted to work with. And of course, in the process of writing the book, we were experiencing all kinds of gun violence just on a regular basis. And now, of course, with George Floyd and the protests that are going on. And so the idea of violence and social justice is always present. And I think that in my work, the idea of the political sort of sleeps side by side with the personal as well. And so these are opportunities for me to explore and examine in writing my poems. So not in the same way that, let's say, a nonfiction writer would write about his or her subject, but finding ways to do that through language in interesting and surprising ways.
Eugene Gloria, thank you so much for your time today.
It was my pleasure.
Eugene Gloria wrote the poetry collection Sightseer in This Killing City, which won this year's Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award for Poetry. Up next, we'll hear from the winners in the genre fiction and emerging authors categories. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're closing out our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards, which recognizes Hoosier authors in 8 different categories, including genre fiction, which brings us to fantasy author Maurice Broaddus. Maurice Broaddus, welcome to All In.
Oh, glad to be here.
So can you tell us about Pimp My Airship? What's it about?
Pimp My Airship is a steampunk novel. And And it's, I mean, steampunk is one of those funny little subgenres that sort of like science fiction and fantasy all mixed together.
Yeah.
But in this world, America lost the Revolutionary War, and it remains a colony of England. And so with that as its history, you know, Pimp My Airship is a story taking place in modern-day Indianapolis with a couple main characters. One is named Sleepy. He's an open mic poet, and there's a professional social provocateur, as he likes to call himself, 120 degrees of knowledge a la, who's trying to recruit Sleepy to join the cause. And then they eventually encounter another lady, whose name is Deaconess Blues. And the three of them basically form a cohort of what does it look like to form a what does it look like to leverage your gifts to, you know, create social change in the order?
What made you want to write this book about these specific themes right now?
So what I do with the bulk of my writing is I tend to, you know, look at the world around me, see what's going on, critique it, and then, but I don't want to just critique it and deconstruct anything. I want to say, hey, this is where we are. These are the systems that we're living under. In the book, we talk a lot of the oppressive systems we're talking about is like redlining and over-policing and criminalizing the poor. So as these themes are just weighing on me as I look at the world around me. But I also want to chart a way forward. I don't want to just sit there and wallow in the fact in the state of this reality. It's like, no, how do we move forward? And that's what I wanted to focus the story on is, you know, you have these different people, one a scientist, one a social activist, and one who's an artist. And what does it look like for them to come together, maintain their agency, and, you know, try to create change in the world around them? Part of that actually stems from my own internal struggle, which is, you know, I was looking at the world around me, and I'm like, well, I'm just a writer. What can I do? And with that question in mind, you know, that's how I approached the stories with that big question. I was trying to answer, if nothing else, for myself, and then hopefully people enjoy the ride.
Do you feel like you answered it, or at least explored it enough?
I do in a lot of ways. Sleepy becomes this fascinating character. Going from, you know, he just focused on, you know what, I have my daily grind, that's all there is, and going to poetry spots, that's my outlet. And then he goes from that sort of mindset to, wait, there are things going on in the world that I can change, or at least that I can see and speak to, and then much less join in with others to create change. And so that process, that roadmap that he creates for himself, sort of became the roadmap I began living my life by. Like, well, hey, you know what? This is actually some good advice he has in here. So let me go ahead and start being more intentional about my own life.
Isn't that interesting that you created this character out of whole cloth and you learned from them? I mean, it's not the first time something like that's happened, but I don't know how has that ever happened before in, I mean, you're no stranger to writing. Have you ever done that? Anything like that before?
This is the first time it's been so explicit, I'll say. I'd actually come up as a horror writer originally. Hmm. And so a lot of my stories then, as I look back, was a different sort of catharsis. It was like I would look around the world around me and I would just sort of be angry. And so that's where a lot of those horror short stories came from, was me writing out of that anger. And so there's been a shift I've noticed in my writing in the last, 5 to 6 years, where I don't just stay in that place of pain and anger. I am more about, what does it look like to move forward? What does it look like to stay in the state of dreaming of better days? And so so my writing originally was me sort of like wrestling with my own internal demons, and now it's me wrestling with this whole aspect of dreaming about a better future.
What does a steampunk Indianapolis look like?
It looks like, honestly, it looks like an excuse for me to just traipse around Indianapolis and just sort of reimagine everything, to be honest with you. It was an excuse for me to, for example, go dig up like the original layout of the city, the turn of the century layout, and then study the turn of the century architecture. And then that became the visual backdrop for the city. I've spent a lot of time digging through the history of different corners of the city. You know, wherever the story would take place, I would go investigate the history of that area of town. Just say, how did we get here? What does that look like? And so all that backdrop of, in fact, I wanted to key in especially on that turn of the century, 19th century Indianapolis. That was where I tried to stay right within that zone. So that was the look, and then throw in things like, robots and airships and things like that, turning the Indianapolis Motor Speedway into an aerodrome, that sort of thing. I stick with the alternate history, but then, I can't get too far away from, who doesn't love a good giant robot just thrown in,
Absolutely. 100%. So what are your future plans? What are you working on next?
Well, I'm working on a second middle grade novel. I had a middle grade novel come out last year called The Usual Suspects. I'm doing a second one, which I will be turning in hopefully in the next couple weeks. It'll be called Unfadable, and it comes out next year. And then I have a science fiction trilogy called All the Stars that I'm working on. So that's going to be my first intergalactic tale. But I'm still determined that Indianapolis is going to play a key role in this. So,
ooh, wonderful. Maurice, thank you for your time.
No, thank you for having me.
Maurice Broaddus is the author of Pimp My Airship, which won this year's Genre Prize in the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. The winners were announced yesterday. Finally today, the awards also recognize emerging authors. Melissa Stevenson won in that category for her memoir, Driven, a white-knuckled ride to heartbreak and back. Melissa Stevenson, welcome to All In.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you tell this story through a very interesting lens. You distinguish these eras of your life, or at least through this story, through the cars you were driving or riding in at the time. Why did you decide to do it that way?
I had tried to tell this story, the story of my brother, his death, growing up with him before that. And I just had great difficulty whenever I would try to write straight to that big story of loss and hurt and grief. I really couldn't quite get the story out. And almost by accident, I realized that in large part, I had been writing about cars as I wrote our story. Our family loved cars, not even fancy cars, just whatever beaters we might have. And then later when I got my first car, that was a wonderful key to independence for me. And then when my brother died, I inherited his car. And so deep into the drafting process of this book, actually, I just kind of had one of those wonderful aha moments when I was working on a segment about our first car, a 1978 Plymouth Volare. And I suddenly started making notes and just kind of traced all our cars from the car my parents got when they were married to the first cars that we grew up with, to my brother's car and my cars. And then I realized that I could use that to structure this much larger, more difficult story.
This book is about a lot of things, but some might say that it's ultimately about the loss of your brother. What was he like?
Oh, that's a great question. I really enjoy that question. He was a very big personality, very magnetic, not because he was loud or dominant, but I know it's a cliche, but anyone who's known this kind of person knows why it's a cliche. He was just one of those people that others gravitated to in a room. You know, he was kind of very empathetic, very sweet, very gentle, but at the same time, a bit of a wild man. You know, he had tattoos when they were more associated with biker gangs instead of body art that anyone might have. And he had a lot of sort of colorful, interesting friends. So just a real mix of gentle, sweet, but he would do some real outlandish things as well. He was fun. He was great fun to be around when he was feeling well.
He passed away from drug addiction. Was part of his personality, do you think, I don't know, was it ever alarming to you?
Absolutely. I'm sure many people have had the experience of watching a loved one succumb to addiction. And I'm no specialist, but I would say his case is the case of a lot of people. I think he probably had a certain level of mood disorder that made for that real magnetic personality, the sort of manic ups and then the lows where he would get very down and retreat. And some of the, when he was on the edges, maybe coming off a manic, really high, fun time, and then going into a low mode, every now and then I just hear a story about how he got intoxicated and tried to pull out his front teeth with pliers, and he'd kind of say it like a joke. And, you know, as his younger sister, I didn't want to correct him, and I felt very helpless, but I remember thinking, oh, that's not a normal, okay thing to do. And so that cycle of less fun and more alarming behavior really escalated towards the end.
What were his drugs of choice?
I think alcohol was the primary drug. And then later, he definitely lived a sort of rock and roll lifestyle and had been on tour with a rock band as their road manager near the end of his life. He loved live music and was a muse and a patron for so many amazing bands. But along with that, I think the more time he spent around the music crowd, the more he went beyond alcohol. You know, I remember some cocaine references, and I always wondered about both heroin and meth, and he never wanted to tell his little sister that stuff. But I think near the end, it was probably just kind of whatever was around. And he wasn't even addicted to hard drugs in the way that I've seen other people addicted to them. I think he just had so much shame over it. And then alcohol was kind of his main battle.
There's obviously a lot in here about substance abuse and mental illness, which I would imagine are primary takeaways from the book for readers. What have you learned about living around that and seeing it happen to people?
You can't save them, in short. And I think writing the book was, for me, was a way of reckoning with that. Watching someone succumb to addiction can be so hard, especially when you're a smart person and you really see it happening. You have that moment where you think, oh, it's not normal to pull out your teeth with pliers. And in hindsight, maybe that's when you have an intervention. Maybe that's when you insist this person gets help. And it's good to help. It's good to express your concern. It's good to be there and be loving. But at the same time, you can't save people. And it took me the entire book writing the book to really work that out. I thought about all the different things I could have done. If I'd done X, Y, or Z, would my brother still be alive? If a butterfly flapped its wings on the other side of the world, would he still be alive? And, you know, in the end, all I could do is take care of my own life, be loving and supportive to him as much as I could be in his life. But you can't stop it. You can't save people and you can't make them better.
How did you try, though? There had to have been ways that you and the family tried to get him help.
Yeah, he wasn't one to ask for help much. I would say I had a very open-minded family that did not lead with anger. So really anything that happened, from some DUIs when he was young and minor possession citations, he would be so hard on himself. And my family was there to help him deal with that, and from the legal details to helping him get car insurance and be able to drive again when he was fit to do so. But just being there, always willing to answer the phone at 2 a.m. if need be, just to talk with him and help him in whatever way was possible. But he died at 29, and in hindsight, that's pretty young. I went through a much more drawn out struggle with alcoholism with my mother, who's passed away. And there are so many more opportunities to get her to rehab facilities and things like that. And he, in hindsight, I see that he hid a lot of his dysfunction, I think, and tried to shield us from that. It's been 20 years now, and in hindsight, it just seems like it happened so fast that we didn't get as many of the opportunities, or didn't recognize them to have the chance to maybe get him some help in the form of rehab or doctors, whatever that might have looked like.
Memoir writing can be painful. It can be cathartic. It can also change your perspective. What did it do for you?
Writing this book definitely had the effect that I didn't expect. I wasn't writing it for this, but I feel like in writing this book, I came out on the other side of the trauma with it holding less power over me, less negative power. I write about grieving in Texas, and I've never lived in the South. And just the way I write about the landscape is so harsh, as if I'm allergic to the fire ants and the humidity and the heat. But it's that landscape got tied up in my grief, and I felt allergic to the place. I felt trapped in my grief. Right after this book came out, it was actually in August, I visited Texas for the first time in maybe 6 or 7 years, and to promote the book. And I found myself wanting to sit outside when my friends didn't. And that sort of claustrophobic, emotional, traumatic hold that the landscape had on me was gone. I could enjoy it. And I felt that way about so many things in the book, that the last thing to come back near the end of the revisions was the humor and the light and the love and the joyful experiences. So I feel like I got a lot of those back, and they're no longer overshadowed by kind of the shame and guilt and heaviness of suicide and loss.
Melissa, best of luck, and thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Melissa Stevenson won this year's Emerging Authors category in the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. The awards were announced yesterday, and the one winner we didn't get to hear from today was Ross Gay, who picked up the prize in the nonfiction category for his 2019 essay collection, The Book of Delights. Our congratulations to him as well, and a big thanks to Indiana Humanities for facilitating these awards and connecting us with the authors. And if you missed part of the series, of course, you can find our podcast feed wherever you get podcasts. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana for discussion and topic alerts. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.